Our guest today is Mike McDermott. After listening to Mike and having our conversation, we just kept on going back to some of his early stories and experiences, and we just can't help but think that these early experiences with learning how to be uncomfortable had an impact on his career trajectory and where he is today. Years ago, Mike saw that the federal space needed some energy and maybe a little bit of a shakeup, which is exactly what he's done. One of the stories you'll hear about today is how Mike essentially negotiated his way into a company as the fourth employee and then later helped to propel it and grow it to over $150 million in revenue over the course of a decade. In his first 12 months at Inquisit, he helped to tack on an additional $28 million in revenue. If you couldn't tell by now, Mike McDermott is a beast. I mean that, like he was literally preparing for a bodybuilding competition at the time of this interview. We had a lot of fun with Mike, and we hope you enjoy today's show.
You're listening to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. My name is Jessica Dubois.
And I'm Derek Wynn. Here, we chronicle the stories of successful business owners and executives who stand out from the crowd.
Whether you're driven by purpose or profit, tune in to learn how these leaders have built successful businesses,
helping to shape the landscape of Northern Virginia.
Welcome to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. Mike McDermott, how are you doing today?
Very good. Yourself?
You know, we're doing great. We appreciate you joining the show. Quick question we wanted to start with, and may not be too quick, depends on, you know, where you go on this, but sure. Tell us, what was it like growing up in the McDermott household?
It was busy. First off, I'm the oldest of four. I've got two brothers and a sister, all about 2 years apart. Good kind of Irish Catholic family, right? My dad actually, as I grew up a little bit, worked from home. So there was just, you imagine with three boys a couple of years apart and the sports and just the high degree of activity. So actually, as we got older, the deal was to keep some of that energy going in the right direction. You had to carry a 3.0 GPA in school in order to play a sport. And we all had to start working by the time we were 14 years old. So it was good. We were kind of grew up really valuing a high degree of work ethic. I actually started delivering newspapers at 12 years old and, you know, would get up, probably 4:35 o'clock in the morning, get on my bike, go throw the papers out and things like that before school. And then got real comfortable early talking about money, which is kind of a funny thing I think people don't necessarily feel comfortable with. And in business, you learn pretty quickly, you better get comfortable with it. And then I did everything from manage a video store to wash dishes to, you know, like typical food service, things like that. I was a substitute janitor for a couple of years, which was a unique experience in and of itself. Kind of, you know, you go through all your friends seeing you literally cleaning toilets after school, and you had to pick your 4-hour block to make soccer practice and all that kind of stuff. So it was very active. You valued a work ethic. I think a lot of kind of good things that come out of that, you get in a lot of uncomfortable situations early. You definitely have to, you learn the value of integrity very early. You know, people try things, they think, and you very much see as a kid people kind of getting caught and getting themselves wrapped up real quick, and you just kind of avoid those types of scenarios. But you got to learn some of those lessons, not all those lessons, but some of those lessons pretty early.
Now, Mike, with all of those various jobs, so I know actually Derek and I both grew up in kind of rural areas, which I think allowed us have some of the same work ethic put in us. So we definitely relate on that. But with going through all of those different jobs, then how do you choose, you know, what do you go in for a profession or what do you go to school for?
So I still don't know exactly what I want to be when I grow up. I really and didn't have at that point huge aspirations, in all honesty. I mean, at one point I figured out that I wanted to do a service academy and wanted to join the military in some capacity pretty early. Just kind of had a innate sense of service, which was one piece. But in all honesty, the scholastics just really didn't interest me. I ended up initially going to Elon on a soccer scholarship and was very early injured. I did, blew my knee out and broke my leg. And at the time, this is exactly how interested I was in the scholastic side. I said, well, geez, if I'm in college and I can't play a sport, why am I even going to stay in college? And decided to join the Marine Corps. And, you know, as a kid growing up, kind of various things. And as I was in the Marine Corps, I got very interested actually in potentially doing federal law enforcement and started to see guys getting out and, you know, joining mostly DEA marshals, things like that. And they had some great stories and having an absolute blast. And it was at that point I realized, okay, now I've got to kind of really finish the academics in order to, you know, pursue that kind of career and be able to be promoted and all those kind of things. And so having dropped out of college and tried to go back a couple of times and actually in the mix there, did get accepted to the Naval Academy and got kicked out of there because my first daughter was born. I was a very early dad and things like that. Decided that I was going to get out of the Marine Corps, be a government contractor, and try to finish my degree. And it was really through that first experience as a program manager very early on in a career that I was exposed to both the types of things that you could do as a government contractor to kind of continue that sense of service, as well as honestly the numbers in the business. I kind of went, you know, I'd like to make that kind of money and have this kind of fun, and decided to do a career that direction.
Mike, tell me on that. So you go to college, you know, primarily, you know, looking at soccer on that, and sports were a big part of where you were. You end up getting injured, and you end up, you know, eventually landing, you know, headed toward the Marine Corps. And from what I understand on this, you know, you go in the Marine Corps, you transition out, and then you recalled, and then you're sent home because you have a child in that. So, you know, at any given point in that process, did you start to, you know, have doubts about the kind of path you were going down? Or did you just kind of push through those? Because again, you talk about being uncomfortable in some of the situations and learning that at a young age. Did that help you through any of those steps?
It did. You know, it's so... You know, if I were to compare myself at that time with my peer group, you know, just age-wise, not even necessarily Marine Corps and everything else, there weren't a lot of folks that were, and more so in the Marine Corps, honestly, that were very young parents. And I very early, you know, just turned 21, my wife at the time 20, we had the responsibility to put food on the table for a family at a very young age. A lot of people are still getting the kind of the partying and things like that out of their system. And so, you know, that experience alone really creates a drive in some cases, you know, at some points in time, a little bit of desperation, because it's not like you have money, you know, growing on a tree in the front yard, especially making the kind of money you do enlisted in the military and just out. So what happened is, so I got out the first time and got a job working at Camp Lejeune, kind of same building and everything else. I literally signed my papers on a Sunday for terminal leave and showed up to work in the same building that next day. And I was on a government contract. There was supposed to be some training going on and some technical support. And so, the first day, the headquarters is in Virginia Beach. The boss comes out to greet me and, you know, kind of make sure I have a good first day and sign all the forms and all the other kind of stuff, and gives me the background of the contract and tells me, don't worry about it. We're going to get a classroom. We're going to do all these kind of things. And I had known the people that were in the contract before. And so I looked at him and I said, so, you know, what if I get this done in the next 30 days? And he kind of laughed at me, which you put yourself at that, you know, 20 something age and you're driven to create something for yourself, and somebody starts laughing in your face. I said, okay, well, why don't we bet? and he shook on it. We bet that I would get a $5,000 raise, which was huge, huge, huge money for me at the time. And I would become the program manager. And he didn't think I could do it. 30 days later, it came back up. And I had managed to get, remember this day, $22,000 of computer equipment put into a classroom, scrounged as much wiring as I could. This is, you know, really before the days of good secure wireless routers and all that kind of stuff. And networked a bunch of computers in this classroom. There was terrible cables all over the place. I'm sure it was a huge fire hazard. But he came back up and he saw, and I kind of went, oh shit, I've got to actually do this now. So, you know, I very clearly recall getting sat down and trying to explain, you know, we have labor category requirements and, you know, you really don't meet them. So, you know, we're still going to have to bring somebody in and that kind of thing. And my temperament at the time, which has only slightly had some edge taken off, I think, was to say, no, you shook. I don't really care what the rules are. You're a gentleman, we shook on it, and we're going to do something. And in my, you know, complete naive at the time, called the government customer to say, hey, and I remember this, Steve Piaskowski at Marine Corps Systems Command. I said, Steve, I'm going to leave this contract unless, you know, this changes here because I need to run this thing. Obviously, I look at all the work I did, you've been trying to get done for over 18 months. And lo and behold, I got the program management job. So I think I was 20, my second daughter was born, so I was probably 22, 23 years old, and was all of a sudden this, you know, program manager of a fairly major program at the time in the Marine Corps, which has since kind of actually gone into the Marine Corps itself, and would get in arguments over everything. I mean, it was, you know, I wanted to hire a certain type of person, and the, you know, my boss was trying to genuinely mentor and coach me through, and I think all I did was fight with him. You know, I would hire who I wanted to hire, and it was a good, interesting experience. I learned a tremendous amount, but at the same time, really started to get my footing under me relative to some confidence in my own decision-making. You know, I talk about arguments over who to hire. I mean, I hired a guy who I remember getting into a little bit of a yelling match, and they did not want me to hire. And that individual actually runs that program today for the Marine Corps 20 years plus later. So it's, you know, those kind of things kind of reinforce, you know, okay, I've got a good gut. And it was nice to kind of have that little assurance, especially at that age. I think a lot of people are still kind of figuring things out. The other component from where you started on the career perspective is, you know, we would go out to the program management meetings. And so, I mean, I had to go to JCPenney and buy a suit that I could barely afford. I don't even remember how I figured out to tie the tie, but I'm sure it was not an appropriate knot to go to this program management meeting, which, you know, I arrive in the room and it looked like a, you know, a Jose Bank convention of, you know, white guys over 50. And I said, whoa, you know, this, and I listened to them talk and everything else. I was like, this, the industry here, I'm looking at these financial charts, is incredibly lucrative. However, I'm listening to some of the things that are happening and the way people are approaching problems and the way in which people think. And I'm thinking to myself, but it's really old. It needs energy. It needs some shakeup. There's areas that are, you know, being ignored that I think people need to pay attention to. And I could see at the time, you know, a little bit more of an adversarial relationship starting to grow with government and contractors, which I think still, you know, prevails in some instances. So it was neat to get all of that. And, you know, at that point I kind of said, okay, this is what I want to do. But of course, I was a kid in his young 20s who had no college education, who had, you know, ideas running around his head and a ton of energy, but that doesn't necessarily fit well in this industry. So I, at that point, I actually got recalled back to active duty. I spent a year supporting the Director of Intelligence of the Marine Corps, did a variety of things. And when I got out again, I job searched in this area. So at that time I was in North Carolina. I moved up to Northern Virginia. I went up and actually ended up going to Maryland because I still wasn't college educated. I said, okay, I got to go to school. So I was taking a full load at the University of Maryland and working at the NSA as a information system security manager, and the Northeast blackout hit. So at the time, there were not a lot of people with my particular skill set at the time, which has since atrophied totally away, but who were doing kind of understood cybersecurity, understood computer forensics, and understood a good bit about human intelligence. And so I got put on as a forensic investigator on a contract that CSC had where we were reporting directly to Congress and stood up in, and this is in 2000, I guess, three, four timeframe, we were in the newly formed Department of Homeland Security building, which was really neat because it was a very vacant building, but you'd ride the elevator up to the third floor with Tom Ridge into the CIO space and stuff. It was just really neat. But did that work for a little bit and just still couldn't edge out. And it wasn't until I was contacted back by Facile at the time, I went to work for eventually about 11 and a half years. It was two business partners who had a tremendous amount of success in the commercial space, had come into the government and were basically looking for talent, really at the time to fill some cyber positions. And in my discussions with one of the founders, he saw something in me at the time that he felt he could really coach up, which he did. And so he said, why don't you meet my business partner and the other guy, and we'll talk about, you know, what things looked like down the road. So it ended up, I was a half an hour late for the interview. So I'm thinking at this point, I'm screwed. You know, there's no way I'm getting this job. I can't even find a building in Crystal City, and they're going to hire me to do security work for the Missile Defense Agency. Those things probably don't go together. But so I ended up getting the job, because at the interview itself, we, you know, spent about a half hour talking and talked some security stuff, and then kind of talked, you know, background, the typical things you do in an interview. And at the end, he said, look, do you have any questions for me? And I said to him, I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. You know, you've had tremendous success. I know that means that you've got money. So if I come into this business, I would like you to let me run sales for you. If I do well, pay me well, and eventually I'd like you to capitalize a business for me. If I don't do well, you can just fire me. And he looked at me and goes, you've got balls. You're hired. We'll figure out the rest. And that was kind of the start of a really, really, really exciting decade plus, where that team, which kind of changed over time, but really there was a core group, we went from four of us at that point. And then I went home and told my wife at the time, I got this great job. I got a pretty good pay raise. Unfortunately, we have no medical care for several months and some of the other stuff that goes on with a startup. But the next several years were exciting. We went from four of us to just about 1,000 employees in that time frame, with the last 5 years of it with me serving as executive vice president and president of the company. And we booked over $500 million in new business just in that 5-year time frame. So it was really a tremendous amount of experience, all the things that you go through in a business, taking it from something that's very small and infantile to something that is now trying to operate in the full and open environment in this market.
And Mike, so I'm thinking back to the story you just went over with us. Now, you didn't really fit the mold of the position of program manager, but you defied all odds for that. And then I'm thinking through also you growing a company, 2,000 employees, and you were late to that interview. Is being kind of not fitting that mold, or like defeating expectations, going beyond that, what people initially think of you, is that like a driver for you?
Yeah, it is a little bit. I mean, sometimes you think of yourself as the underdog and you got to fight through. I think there's a little bit of that. Some of it is, honestly, I don't fit many molds. I mean, you know, I know this is a podcast, but, you know, people that know me, I bodybuild on the side. I, you know, typically weigh anywhere between 250 and 280 pounds. I'm sleeved in tattoos. Don't wear a suit a lot, frankly, because I don't fit in most of them. And that's today. And I've always kind of been that way. I'm kind of, it's me. I am who I am. You don't like it, that's fine. I'm going to operate in a way and live in a way and run an organization in the way that I think is healthy. And, you know, if there's stuff I could take away from others' situations, great. But I really think I've always done best figuring things out for myself.
Like, let's kind of dig into a couple of those things. And I also want to come back to, you know, your transition out of Facile into, you know, Inquisit IT and everything in between. Sure. But let's just talk a little bit about just that health side of things, right? So, I mean, you're right now preparing for a competition, right? Amateur bodybuilder.
Yes.
Six meals a day. You yep. work out 2 to 3 hours a day. And you're running a super successful business, right? So going back to believing in doing what's right for an organization, do you think you have an impact on your employees when they see everything you're doing too?
Yes. Yeah. I would tell you yes. I couldn't tell you exactly what it is. I get feedback like that, which is really, really, really nice to hear. I think one of the things that I've had to actually brush the edge off of is understanding not everybody has the same energy level and all of those same desires, but it doesn't equate to them not being able to contribute in the same way or even better. And what I mean by that is, you know, early in my career, you know, I was the guy who was literally on email, you know, 24/7. And, you know, you emailed me or text or whatever, you were going to get something back very, very quickly. And then you kind of realize that over time, all these things you do, which may be, you know, good for you and other people look at as great, it can be actually intimidating to others. They don't necessarily feel like they can keep up, or they feel like because you're doing all this stuff, you expect it of them, and then they start doing it, and then they feel overworked, and you've never actually levied the requirement. So the feedback, as good as it is, I think it's like anything else. You've got to understand kind of both sides of the coin and figure out what is the best way to lead, not necessarily for yourself, but for others. I mean, leadership is about others in the way that you get them moving, get them inspired, get them going, all that kind of stuff. And you could be doing a lot of things that you think are wonderful and in actuality have, you know, another side that they are a negative side that it's creating. And that's actually a little bit of that. So to answer your question, it's, you know, yes, and definitely have folks that, because I value work ethic, I hire people that also value work ethic and those types of things. But at the same time, you know, really recognize that people have a whole lot of stuff that they enjoy, and it can have absolutely nothing to do with anything that they do in work, and they need that time to do that. So you've got to be careful about what you yourself enjoy and then how those turn into even unverbalized expectations, and make sure that you verbalize that you expect people to have their own kind of healthy outlets and things.
I mean,
Oh, go ahead, Derek.
I was just going to say, I mean, for me personally, I kind of live that, right? So it's, how do you be that guy who's on email 24/7, 365, but also carry pursuits outside of business? And the thing we haven't talked about yet, which is take care of your family, yep. Right? I mean, you've got, what, 4 daughters, right? Yep. So, I mean, what is your advice to other people, even if they're not running a business, but let's say they are running a business, who don't have time to eat right because time is the biggest thing, who don't have time to work out because, again, time is the biggest excuse why, and may not have time for family? Like, how do you do it all?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't define myself as perfect in any sense, but I'm a huge advocate of people very purposefully managing their time. And what I mean by that is everybody feels a bit overwhelmed. And when I tell people, and I've done a lot of executive coaching, and executives, I think, like as you're articulating, kind of battle with this more than others, but I think everybody has an element of it, which is a lot of people just feel like they've got more to do than there's time in the day to do it. And then there's those things that you would really love to do, like get to the gym more or whatever that is. So I tell people that they've got to kind of plan out their ideal day or their perfect week. And what I mean by that is they take a week or two even and list out the things that are the absolute most important things for you to do, as well as the things that you just have to get done. And, you know, work is, you're going to have some work things in there. You're going to have some personal things in there. You're going to have some family things in there. And you're going to have more on that list than you're most likely able to accomplish. So the next thing you got to do is now order that list and kind of figure out what falls off. I think as an executive, there's a secondary component to that, which is, gosh, there's a guy that does a lot of organization stuff, and he has the do, delegate, and delete. So, you know, you have things that you personally should do, but then, especially as executives, I coach them, you've got to leave some white space for yourself. And so you have people that you can delegate tasks to. So figure out what you actually need to do, what others can do, and then really look at what actually needs to get done. You know, I do this myself and have to kind of step back, which is, you know, you may want to take on, for example, for us, maybe I'm looking at putting out a new performance system within the company. You're looking at how we do recruiting in the company. Then you're looking at maybe you want to go after the new CMMC certification. You got all of these things to do. You have people that are going to do some of those things. And maybe it's not right to try to do 5 projects because of the resource you have. So pick the top 2 or 3 that are most important and start to do those. So do those types of activities and then actually lay that out on a calendar and start to plan your day and your time around those things that you've kind of gone through some process of your own to decide what's most important and what you're going to prioritize. And if you do that, then what I find personally and you know, been able to fit a lot in my day is that you really can get more in than you realize. And it's much more fulfilling to take the time to do that and know that you're acting on the things that you prioritize as opposed to having what the alternative kind of turns into is everybody else starts managing your day.
And the same way that you structure your time or coach yourself, is that the same way? I mean, it sounds like that's the same way that you kind of lead your team.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. And the component to that, you know, relative to leading the team is having a very kind of crystallizing a view of what you want people to get done and have accomplished. I'm a firm believer in kind of painting the picture of the end zone, or what is it that you want measured, or what is it that you want people to do and accomplish, and at what rate, or, you know, what are you going to, how do you measure their success, and be very clear about that to the individual, and then let them kind of figure it out. And you're better off coaching them through that a little bit than you are demanding it. So, you know, I personally think, you know, the days of kind of time punching and things like that, where everybody's got to be in on a certain amount of time, or that, those days are over. People have a very different lifestyle now than they did, you know, just 10 or 20 years ago, let alone when a lot of what I think of as typical business practices kind of came into play. They're there kind of because they've been there, not really for any good reason. So I'm an advocate of kind of looking at the way you do business to go, what's going to be the best way that our organization's going to function, as opposed to kind of blindly adopting business practices.
Mike, you know, run with that for a second too, because you talk about the way business has been done in the past versus the way it's being done today. You know, what's your general outlook on the government contracting segment as a whole? Like, kind of what are you seeing today, and what's your opinion on the landscape overall?
Gosh, a loaded question and probably a bit to unpack. I think that from a larger picture, I mean, we are seeing unrest in healthcare. We're seeing unrest in kind of general civil population, and we're seeing economic unrest. And when those things happen, it tends to act as an accelerant to change. And I think we're kind of living through that. So I think that what we're seeing right now on the political side and everything else is, over the next several years, going to lead to what we see as a lot of change and reform. You know, I'm a little bit of a history buff. I think that our modern economy and modern kind of general government practices are really based around a lot of what came through the New Deal. You know, we've worked within a global economy for a very long time, and I think we're going to start to see some of those things shift, because I think as you start answering some of these questions, or looking for answers, I should say, to some of these questions, some of it comes down to really appropriately compensating communities and people so that, you know, they can feel the freedom that we talk about, kind of thing. So, you know, as that kind of pulls a thread into government contracting, I think that we are going to see changes in the way that the government does business. I think we're seeing a new demographic come into the government space over the last several years. There's been a, you know, high degree of retirements, and we're seeing a kind of a younger crowd come in that is got an appetite to really update things, that is not as tied to the government as they have been in the past. So they're less afraid of popping back and forth between government jobs and commercial jobs, which means that hopefully that bridge between government and industry starts to get a little bit stronger as some of these changes take place. And we're going to see the government, you know, start to really, I think, act a little bit more like large, more commercial-ish, if you will, because the, you know, that right now the threat of things like cyber, you know, loom. We've got a drive to get more people remote. We've got to look at what we're doing on the cloud front and those kind of things. So I think that, you know, we're going to continue to see the technologies accelerate. Of course, everybody's going to talk about AI and all of that kind of stuff. But I think we also need to look at what the impact is from a civil sense, right? So, hey, once, you know, you want a glimpse of what restaurants might look like in the future and where technology comes in, you know, go to Newark Airport, where you're not going to find a waiter or waitress. But that's all wonderful. But what's the reality behind where we are as an industry in terms of the ability to develop those kind of things at a pace that really keeps up? And are we ready for what the impact is on the more civil population side when you have, I think McKinsey reported that they're looking at with advancement of AI, you could have 50 to 70% of both the retail and the service industry really fall from a labor perspective. So there's a lot of impacts there that I think also need to get looked at. So it's probably a much longer answer than you were looking for, but.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's spot on. And in being history buff too, I mean, you just think about just recent history. I mean, you think about how the global war on terror has kind of shifted in terms of spend. And then you think about how, you know, the LPTA environment shifted in terms of procurement. And you look at how shutdowns have shifted due to politics, right? So I think it's all of those things put together. So knowing that and kind of knowing where we are today, what are the things you're doing at Inquisit as far as kind of that runway that you see going forward?
Sure. Yeah, so a couple of things. I think the biggest thing that we're doing is spending a lot of time, and I spend a lot of time really trying to understand, you know, we're in the IT space. So what are the problems that are plaguing our customers right now, both our direct customers, as well as our customers as a whole, the CIOs throughout the federal government. And then really starting to take a look at those problems and the skill sets that we have within the firm and the types of solutions that we have or can maybe construct based upon what those problems are and where we think they're going. We've got a group inside of the company called, we call it iForce. And so one of the problems that I found in this industry is there tends to not be a lot of options for career pathing of your employees because of the nature of the contractual side of the work. However, what we could do is we can try and create something inside the organization where we can career path folks into a space where they can contribute to the business, learn the business side of things a little bit more, help us out in some of the marketing proposal work and things like that as well. And they tend to be some of our, I'll say, our top thinkers in the business. And so what we do here is we pull those folks together and we'll kind of facilitate sessions where we look at, okay, so what are the problems that are facing the CIO today, the mid-manager today, the CTO today? Where is technology going? And are we really doing all we can as a company to not respond to all of those issues, but try and be ahead of some of those issues and understanding directionally where they want to go and be there and ready for them?
Well, we've talked a lot about kind of the technical aspects of this, but I did read in an interview that you wrote or that you were a publication that you were interviewed on, and you said that a challenge in this industry is that it can take years to truly differentiate an organization and have it be recognized. Mm-hmm. Is that have to do with the people aspect of the business or how you recruit and retain talent?
Well, that's an aspect of it. So I think, you know, one of the things that is difficult in this industry, and even, you know, we've already done it here as we've talked, you know, well, you're a government contractor, everybody kind of immediately has a picture of kind of what that is. And it really isn't all that different from company to company. And a lot of organizations in this industry, really, people will put a company together and kind of look around and see what other folks are doing. And a lot of people replicate others that they believe have been successful in the market, as opposed to trying to truly define themselves as themselves. And because of that, if you're that type of company, and they're out there, I mean, we're not the only one, then it's a little harder for you to be seen. It's kind of playing a little bit of Where's Waldo, because so many companies in this industry, really, not only do they kind of look and act the same, but they are lumped together by both our customers, as well as the folks that are searching for jobs. And you know, DC is notorious for this, right? Having people move from company to company for a couple $1,000 raise or better benefits or whatever it is. And part of the issue, the reason you see so much of that is the companies themselves aren't differentiated enough that employee feels like they're at a different place. And so what we try to do with that and where that experience for the employees, one of the components, who and how we recruit into the business and things like that, we do try to create a place that is different. And honestly, that, you know, I want to create an organization that's not only successful in all of the sense of the business, but is the kind of place where, you know, 50 years from now, you know, grandkid asks the grandparent, what did you do when you were working or, you know, whatever. And one of the first things that comes to mind is inquisitive. You know, that just that thought alone would be, in my mind, success. It would be something that somebody has this great memory of, this great business that had the success from all of the financial metrics and everything else. It was also a really fun place to be. And the other thing that we do is we have defined our culture in what we call the Inquisiteer Credo. And so what that's able to do is kind of give folks a sense of who and how we hire and kind of what we're looking for. In this industry, something like that is even a little more difficult than some, or I would say, dare to say, and than most, to really put together, because our employee base is out with a whole bunch of different customers. So I've got to have a strong culture that individual feels like they're a part of something different and something hopefully bigger than themselves. But at the same time, that culture cannot be an affront to USDA, the Department of Justice, the Environmental Protection Agency, the US Navy, the US Army, and all of the different customers in different places where those employees are outperforming. And so it really is just based upon a lot of what I kind of cast as really good business practices in terms of being responsive and having accountability and taking responsibility, but formalizing that so folks understand it's an expectation. And when you see a violation of it, you're able to kind of say, look, this isn't about you and me. This is about the organization and something we've all decided that we're going to live by, and you violated it. And so now, you know, then you got to have a talk.
Yeah. Well, and going through, you know, the success of, you know, building companies on your own, but then also like kind of rising through the ranks of other companies. Now you've kind of had this bootstrap mentality, I feel like a little bit rough around the edges, but this ability to exceed all expectations. Are there mentors or people who have inspired you, who've kind of helped lead you down this path, or that you've looked to as an inspiration?
Oh, yeah. And I think, yes, for sure, to answer it. And that's also changed over time. I mean, coming up, my dad was, and both my parents, my dad was a huge person for me. Like I said, I grew up outside New York City in New Jersey, and he drove a Pepperidge Farm bread truck through the Bronx, and now owns and has so for over 10 years, well, geez, it might be 20 years, almost 20 years, his own successful food brokerage firm in the ingredients industry on the manufacturing side. So, you know, being, you know, and like I said, he worked from home. So being under the same roof with somebody who himself made that trek, I think becomes innate in you. And I can tell you, my brothers, who are both younger than me, one of them was a COO and just sold a company and moved on to a VP of sales while he's kind of waiting out a little bit of his time. My other brother's a regional vice president and turned down a chief marketing officer job because he kind of likes his lifestyle. But we've all kind of been able to find that success. I think a lot of that was from him. And the things that go along with that, one of the most fun stories to tell is actually when I was 15 years old, you know, it was a big deal to get working papers. You got to make sure you're paying into Social Security as a kid. And I found out at the end of the year, in doing my taxes, in a letter that had come back from the IRS, that my boss at a restaurant was pocketing my tax money, but giving me pay stubs that said that they were put back. And of course, she's thinking this, you know, this kid's never going to do his own taxes. And sure enough, I did. And with my dad's guidance. And so once I got the letter back from the IRS, it said they basically never heard of me and didn't have any of my money. I was coached through by my dad to go and confront this woman to get my money. And I very clearly remember him driving to the front of the restaurant and looking at me and going, all right, I'll wait here. And it was at that moment I went, oh, I thought you were coming. and he didn't. And so, you know, and I went in and I did get my money and, you know, had to, at 15 years old, threaten an adult who was probably in her 40s. It was those types of lessons and things like that growing up that I think built, you know, things that I was able to push on a little bit later. At Facile, Sasha Mornell, who was one of the founders, I worked for that entire time. And, you know, in the last couple of years, it was a little more distanced only because they became part of a board and I was really running the company as an operator. But, you know, I felt like they used to joke that I owe him money because I got a Harvard education from him. He was a Harvard MBA, and I think it was pretty close to that, which is very cool. And, you know, I've had, you know, some folks might know Steve Blattis is an executive coach of mine. And he, you know, he saw me through some of the things at Facile, which did come to an end somewhat abruptly and not on the best note, which, you know, is an executive when you are in charge of a firm and you have immersed yourself in it, especially when you are there at kind of the, I wouldn't say, now obviously not a founder, but some of the founding moments. And then all of a sudden that disappears. You know, you go through a lot and you have a whole new learning that you do. So you have different people at that point in my life that have kind of said, you know, okay, well, let's, okay, so we got to do something new now. So yes, I've had mentors and they do change along the way.
So Mike, thinking about that and just again, the continuing evolution, I mean, paperboy, all-star soccer player, Marine, you know, negotiating a way onto a PM role, you know, negotiating a way into other organizations and roles and things like that. What are you negotiating yourself into next? Like, what's your five-year plan look like? Because I know you said before you don't know what you want to be when you grow up, which I say the same thing. So maybe what do you plan to be when you grow up?
We would like to execute a management buyout or something here on that side with Inquisit to go from an operator role to a true owner CEO role and take this business really forward. I think that we've got a tremendous amount of gas in the tank still, which is a kind of a nice place to be. Then I think that there's going to be a natural progression to this business, while at the same time my tendency is to continue to have interest in other areas and other businesses. I'm looked at consulting things. I've kept my executive coaching business up and running, but just a few clients, just primarily because of time. And that's been fun. I think that there's still some white space in this industry on the business to business side that I'd love to capitalize on and do some things. And, you know, after that kind of really, you know, long-term 5 years and beyond, I don't know. I mean, I'd love to give the consumer market a try and really the organic commercial market a try, but my drive for and public service, and it really tends to override a lot of that. I would love to just continue to, at the end of my career, be able to look back and know that not only did I have this, you know, cool business success, but really impacted people for the better along the way. And so that's, you know, that's a tough thing to find if you're purely commercial all the time.
And especially I could see that with the leadership coaching, right? It's a way to kind of, you know, help others and just create mm-hmm. that impact. So if people are looking to try to get in touch with you, how would you recommend they go about doing that?
LinkedIn is probably one of the best ways. I don't respond to everything immediately there, but I do get through everything. You know, if you hop on there, you'll get my email, my personal email, and my cell phone is right there. And, you know, I've hired off of that. I've put people in touch with others that got hired. I've gotten clients. I've done a lot. So I think that has been a very, very good kind of networking platform.
Awesome. Mike McDermott, thank you so much. Been a joy having you here on the show and a lot of great information for anyone out there.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in. You can listen to this episode and subscribe to future episodes on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to give us that 5-star review so that we can get our podcast out to more and more listeners. If you are a business leader or know of any business leaders that you would like to nominate to be a guest on the show, please visit us at thenovabusinesspodcast.com.